It's May 21st, 2023, and welcome to episode 266 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, who knows what, old phones. Who knows what we'll talk about today? 1966, maybe. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts today, Quinn Dunkey in rural British Columbia.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good. It's thunderstorming today, which is a novel thing for me, having since recently moved back here from California, where thunderstorms are not a thing. So it's very exciting. The sound, the sky makes sound and flashes of light. It's very exciting.
Very cool. Very cool. Also joining us is Blake Patterson, near DC. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. I think we're having a little more of a mild, weathered day today than you are, Quinn. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's going well, and things are rolling.
Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely trying to be summer now. So thunderstorms and the warmth.
Yeah, it's been hot here, too. We had a crazy heat wave last week.
Mm-hmm. So we have, as we've, you know, I reintroduce this every time, but like we've been going through the recent episodes, sort of tying it to the year that relates to the last two digits. So this is episode 266, and we would talk about things that had something to do with 1966 as our topic. And it's actually a little bit difficult to find. We were talking about this a little before we started recording, but to pin something down on a year is actually quite difficult because, you know, unless it's like the publication of an article or something like that, it's not usually there was some work that went into the release and then, you know, at the first shipped 2 years later or whatever. So, but let's see. One thing that came up as a 1966 date was Eliza. That was there was a publication in the ACM. What is that? Association for Computing Machinery, I think. Is that what that is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By Joseph Weizenbaum, sort of outlining what it is. So we all know Eliza. I actually didn't realize initially that Eliza was more general in a sense. Like it isn't the therapist. It's the system, and the therapist was one example.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically the proto chatbot, right? Like it's the great 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 grandmother of ChatGPT, which is topical for considering ChatGPT is doing amazing things seemingly hourly right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I sort of skimmed through it and then I haven't made it all the way through, but it's interesting to hear sort of like the original thoughts on it as well. You know, like what was being accomplished, why the model of a therapist is a good one, because you have to get people to talk.
Yeah.
You know, like you have to get them to say something.
Yeah, and because response is much easier than initiating a thought. So it's much easier to react to something that's being said to you and sound convincing at that, which is, if we're all being honest, most of what a lot of therapists do is just react to things you say and say things to keep you talking, which is part of the therapeutic process. So it's easier for a chatbot to do that. There's a lot of, oh, really? How do you feel about insert noun here?
Yeah, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, it's always amusing when it just starts sounding ridiculous. But
yeah.
still, at the same time, it does a pretty good job sometimes too. So
it does. And in fact, there was a version of this that ran on the Apple II, which was again surprisingly good considering how little hardware it's running on and how little code it's running on. It's remarkable how convincingly human something can sound with so little.
Yeah,
it's interesting that it's sort of ironic actually. I think I'd heard of Eliza. I think prior to the situation I'm describing, I had an Apple IIc, and before that a TI-99, and I'd heard of Eliza. I don't think I ever had it on the Apple. But I purchased one of the very first Amigas in 1985. And one of the, interestingly, the first commercial package, I mean, software was slow in coming. I purchased in October 85, and it was like November, late November. The first commercial package that I saw anywhere was Electronic Arts had this, you may have heard of it. It was a little bundle called Software Golden Oldies.
Oh,
which
yes,
was
right.
Like, you know, the game of like life, not the game of life, but, you know, the automaton, you know, little mathematical simulation thing. I think it had Pong. It also had Eliza, among other small things. And so just interestingly, the first thing I ran on arguably the most powerful, you know, consumer-based system at that time, you know, under like, you know, $10,000 was a package of Golden Oldies, including Eliza. So that was one of my first Amiga experiences. Not really a definitive Amiga experience, but I was amused by it as a, I guess, as a 13-year-old. So that was fun. I always thought it was weird that was my first outing on the Amiga.
Yes,
yeah, it does exist for the Apple II as well. This is on the stream. This is the disc. Mm-hmm. Adventure, Eliza, Life, and Pong.
It's a funny combination of four random things that they dug up from some Usenet post or something. Someone found the source code or whatever.
Right.
There's been a lot of discussion around this because of ChatGPT lately. This idea, like, why is it that these chatbots can sound so convincing with so little? And it boils down to the fact that we're doing half of the work when we talk to them. So humans are hardwired to see agency in other things because it's a very primal survival instinct. When you see the bushes move, it's far more survivally advantageous to assume that something is moving those bushes with agency than to assume not. It's the failure mode of being wrong about that is safer if you assume everything that moves around you is moving with agency. So that wiring is so deep in us that when we see something like using reasonably structured English, it's very, very easy for us to map an intelligence onto that, which is why everybody's freaking out over ChatGPT, which is literally just statistically analyzing giant volumes of text, but people are applying all manner of, you know, assumed intelligence to it that just isn't there. So there's a lot of moral panic happening about ChatGPT when it's literally just a statistical analysis of language and nothing more. But anyway, that's a separate podcast, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Though when you talk about the brain filling things in, I have to bring up the faces and things.
Oh yes, pareidolia.
Pareidolia.
Yeah.
These are quite quite amusing. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Yeah, that is that is a very, again, another very powerful circuit in our brains that's deep in there, the Jesus and toast effect.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder. I'm surprised I haven't seen it. I wonder if anyone's actually. Surely they have tied Eliza to ChatGPT and had it go back and forth.
I mean, that would be funny, like when people would make chess programs play each other on 80s
right,
computers.
Right, right.
So, yeah, we should have Eliza and ChatGPT talk to each other.
Mm-hmm. But you could probably actually ask ChatGPT to program Eliza and then talk to it.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Ooh, that could get interesting.
So let's see, what other things? 1966 also brought up the first flying of the Apollo guidance computer.
Mm. Okay.
So obviously it was being developed before that, but it first went up on AS-202, whatever that was, August 25th, 1966. So there is a date, you know, that you can assign to it. You know, it existed before.
Yeah.
But
the AGC is an amazing piece of work. There's a couple of really good books written about it if anyone is not familiar with the whole story there, because you see a picture of it, like, it's on the stream now here, and it looks like a pretty straightforward piece of embedded computing, like, you know, is a dime a dozen. But it's hard to overstate how much of a leap forward that was in technology, because it's doing, that little box is doing what previously took, you know, rooms and rooms full of vacuum tubes and relays. And they managed, MIT managed to get it down into that little box. It really is astonishing how well miniaturized that thing is, with no integrated circuits. It's all discrete hardware. So it's, yeah, it really was. It was like aliens from 10 years further in the future went back and gave it to them. That's like how much of an advance that thing really is. in recent years, it has gotten the well-deserved attention for that, fortunately. There's a lot of emulators for it, and Fran Blanche, one of my favorite YouTubers, got her hands on one, and she's been restoring it, you know, redoing the display on it and stuff. So lots of good work being done on AGCs, fortunately, or the Disky, as it's affectionately known.
Mm-hmm. That's the Disky is that display box, right?
Yeah, exactly. Technically, just refers to the display and keyboard unit. Yeah, and the amusingly, the astronauts, a bunch of hard-boiled test pilots, had to learn hexadecimal because, of course, the user interface is all like it's basically a glorified front panel from like an Altair. They're keying in values into memory locations, but it happens to be done with hex instead of binary toggle switches. But and of course, the buttons had to be big enough to work with big astronaut gloves on. But not that they're wearing the pressure suits in the capsule, but they're still wearing gloves and stuff. So anyway, yeah, it's a neat piece of hardware.
Anything else there was one other thing that I was going to bring up. The thing that I came across was a description of the Carter phone. I've put on the stream a picture of a sort of a clear one. But what it is basically, it's kind of like an acoustic coupler, like you stick the phone in it, and it apparently sort of serves as a mediator to the radio. So it's a way to sort of like jointly like use the phone to talk to someone on the radio and vice versa. I'm not quite sure what the story is, but I believe what the deal was that they were selling these from about like 1955 to 1966 when I think it was Bell filed suit, basically saying you can't connect to this, you can't connect to our stuff.
Right.
And so in 1968 there was a decision that said basically they basically ruled against Bell, saying you can connect other things to the Bell system. Anyway, so that was 1966.
That's actually, again, there's another sort of relevant callback to current events there. I mean, that must have been one of the earliest decisions around the gray area between privately owned infrastructure and public utility. At some point, they had to decide, okay, even though private companies built, pay for, and own these phone lines, we have to treat them as a public service. You know, that battle was fought again over internet and has been relitigated again recently in the United States. The U.S. Supreme Court looked at, again, the responsibility, you know, how much responsibility do platforms have for the content that's on them? And, how much, I think the case was around, someone had blamed a YouTube video for radicalizing their kid or something along those lines. Forgive me, I don't have the details in front of me, but, I think they declined to hear the case this time. But, anyway, so this is something that continues to come up over and over again, is where is that line between private and public infrastructure? So, luckily, the phone companies lost. Otherwise, we wouldn't have BBSs and all the other glorious things.
Yeah, that was the thing I was thinking, was that it did really sort of like allow modems and all that stuff. So.
Modems. Mm-hmm.
Although we did all have the exact same phone for 30 years there, which had its own advantages. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of standardization that happened just because we were all forced to rent terrible phones from the phone companies.
Yeah. So we are joined actually by Lane Nooney now, who has recently published a book called The Apple II Age, How the Computer Became Personal, and we wanted to hear a little bit about that. So Lane is Assistant Professor of Media and Information Industries at NYU, and we're quite interested to sort of hear about your history with the Apple II, the book process, and anything that winds up seeming relevant. So welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you.
I can tack on to that introduction. Some of our listeners might remember Lane from an episode of Open Apple many years ago. Em and I interviewed Lane about, it was your previous book, right, that you had written? Or was that?
It was. So this is the Apple II Age is the only book I've written, but at the time I was working on a dissertation about Sierra Online. That was a really big project and has been moved to my second book.
That's what it was. Yes. Okay. And it was an awesome conversation that has spawned a lot of similar conversations here on RCR, because we talked a lot about a lot of fun stuff, particularly around how the home computer injected itself into domestic life and how we all had to figure out the details around that. Like, new furniture had to be invented, printer stands were invented, and we had to figure out what room does the computer go in. Is it a kitchen thing? Is it a basement thing? Nobody really knew. So, yeah, we've talked a lot about the RCR, about that interview in those sorts of contexts. So, yeah, we're really glad to have you back here.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah, I think that interview must have been, what, 10 years ago almost?
Has it been that long? Wow.
Jeez. I feel like it was 2013 or 2014.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Wow, where does the time go?
Maybe, 2015, if we're lucky at this point.
Yeah, but so I guess maybe what led to your wanting to write this book? I mean, like how did the book come into being?
I mean, so the really frank answer to that is that when I showed up at my job at NYU, I was working on this Sierra book project, and the Sierra book project is massive. It's like it was intended as a 40-year history of a company that would also be telling the entire history of the computer game industry in the United States. And if you know anything about academia, particularly academia at universities that think a lot of themselves, like New York University does, there is this bar you have to pass to get tenure, and an important part of that is having your book out, especially if you are a historian, right? So in academia, historians have to write books. That is their main unit of intellectual currency. And everyone was like, it doesn't seem like you're going to get this Sierra book done in the next 2 years, Lane. What's your plan? And I was like, I don't have one. And so basically there was a conversation in which it was suggested that I write something else. That was literally the prompt, was like, could you write any other book? And in the middle of that wild conversation, I sort of, you know, I had to do a ton of work understanding very early computer culture to be able to begin doing the Sierra project. So there was a ton of reading and kind of background, you know, research I had done on the Apple II, because that was the first computer Ken and Roberta Williams designed for, and then also just to understand the way the industry was shaped, its kind of unique industrial and economic politics, and to understand what kinds of things were people first doing with computers. I had spent a lot of time in the archives of Soft Talk magazine, and so I had this really deep knowledge of a lot of this stuff that other, you know, scholars didn't have. And I was like, well, what if I spackle this together and do kind of a platform study of this computer, but told through the idea of different software categories? That was my pitch in that room, was what if we think about the history of personal computing as being a story of like the different reasons people owned computers, and those reasons materialize in the kinds of software they buy. And that was the initial pitch. And I'm shocked the book actually stayed true to that initial premise as strongly as it had.
That's
how we got this book, right?
That's fantastic. I mean, that dovetails into a lot of what we talk about on RCR, which is early on, of course, computers, we knew they were going to be something, but nobody really knew what. And all the early adopters, of course, were just engineers and very highly technical nerds who we all bought them just to buy them because we liked them. But then we all sat down and looked at them and tried to figure out what to actually do with them. And so we got a lot of really silly applications, like everybody put their recipes on them. And, you know, we fumbled around for many years trying to figure out what to actually do with these things that was better than what we were currently doing. Like, oh, I can put my appointments in it, but that's actually objectively worse than a paper appointment book was in, you know, 1982 or whatever. So I think your perspective in the book of looking at it from a software angle is really powerful in that way, because that was really what endeared them to all of us, that okay, this actually is better than the old ways of doing things. Like, the cover of your book has the print shop graphic on it there, which is a perfect example of something that a home computer does that's objectively better than any other way we had to do it before, which was mimeographing or going down to the sign shop and using their photocopier or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. And I think a big part of the take I try to put forward in this book is this idea that, like, yeah, so computer people always say this, right? We saw computers and we knew they'd be a thing. But I would say that a general consumer marketplace did not see that. And that's a part of the story that's been, I think, really overlooked. And it's not a story that suddenly they had to, like, wake up to the power of computing. It's that computing really had to be reimagined and repositioned and tied to all these other kind of, like, political and kind of economic phenomena that were going on during the 1970s and 80s in order for people to even care about it. I mean, home computing kind of stagnated basically throughout the 1980s. They really thought it had kind of failed as a project. At least certainly industry investors and journalists were like, no one wants to buy a home computer because it doesn't do anything. And that's a very different story that we than what we get from, I think, a lot of writing and books that mostly are written by people who are fans, journalists, collectors, enthusiasts, people who feel like they saw the thing happening live and were believers. And I really wanted to kind of tell a story that was kind of like, you know, counter to that, or gave a lot of credence to what most people thought, which was like, why would I even own this to begin with, right? Yeah. I really like picking up their position of frustration, uncertainty, disbelief, thinking all of this was bullshit, you know?
Yeah, a lot of history is written as though it was inevitable, like it was this obvious sequence of events. So this was better than this was better than this, and that's why we did it. But no, like you said, the computer had to, the home computers had to prove themselves. Like all of the parents and non-technical people who looked at that and thought, that's just a really expensive waste of time. I don't understand what that's actually for. So, you know, it took 15 years of the nerds just using them for games, which, let's be honest, is all they were really used for the first 15 years. Until they found their niche for sure. It was not an inevitability that they were going to become what they did. I guess let's say that.
I know that just thinking back on the actual 80s, it was actually fairly lonely. You know, I mean, there were a couple of us, and we'd get together and use each other's computers or whatever. But I mean, like for the most part, the people you saw in school, like, they didn't know what this was. Nobody. We always had the computer lab to ourselves.
it was a hobby like model trains, where if you were into it, you were super into it. But all of the mainstream, you tell them what you do, and they're like, "Oh, okay, great." Anyway, you know, it was not something that anybody understood if you weren't really in there.
I remember being pretty impressed, and I think it must have been like, you know, very early 90s, seeing like a web address on a bus. I'm like, all right, we've made it now.
Here we go. Yeah,
finally. I remember the early years of like local news broadcasters reading URLs on the air, and because of course they didn't understand which characters were important, so they would read out the HTTP and the slashes, and comedy gold to a nerd.
Yep.
Yeah, it's funny. I similarly remember you mentioned the bus, that kind of thing. Yeah, I remember signage, you know, in public and on, you know, on vehicles, on buses. Like it seemed I was, you know, well aware and one of the lonely people that was using all this tech for quite some time before the internet. But it still felt really, really strange to see that, you know, like, wow, that's a URL on an email address on a sign. That's now it's, you know, standard.
So Lane, in your book, you also talked about piracy and kind of the moral gray area of that and how that evolved. Can you tell us a little bit more about like what your angle on that is in the book?
Yeah. So I have, just to describe kind of briefly the organization of the book, I have, because it's a book that kind of has to do a lot of different things and really is angled at responding to a sort of general or maybe an interested general readership, right? So I have a chapter that sort of explains how did we get to what had to happen for something like personal computing to even become possible. I have a chapter about the kind of foundation of Apple Computer, the creation of the Apple II. It's very much a Wozniak Jobs story. Mike Merkula also being important there. But the real bulk of the book is organized into these five chapters that I say are sort of concurrent case studies that are each organized around a specific category of software and then has one specific case study that I tell that story through. So it goes business, games, utilities, home, and education. and where I talk about software piracy is in some ways more of a byproduct of the case I chose in the utilities chapter. There's a lot of different, you know, utilities is sort of this kind of like unsung software category, right? It was really the place where the interests of like hobbyists and hardcore computer users would have been expressed in the market. But I chose Locksmith, which was a copy breaking piece of software. And then there was a number of reasons that was a really interesting case. One, it seemed a lot of the, from a historical perspective, Locksmith is really a strange artifact because it basically appears and you get evidence that it exists really briefly in the record because there was it was quickly blacklisted by the entire industry. So it only was advertised for a couple months. You never see articles or interviews with the person who was the publisher. No one even knows who programmed it, right? So there's a really good historical puzzle there of like, this was an incredibly important and widely used piece of software that we know almost historically nothing about because the way the industry reacted removed any kind of like archival evidence of its existence, right? And so that chapter is really about trying to make the case of why did people need copy-breaking software, not just for piracy, actually. I wanted to take seriously the reasons people might buy a program like this because it really tells you a story about how hard it was to use computers, how fragile they were, how difficult, how kind of silly they were. I mean, there's all of these beautiful stories you get of people who write into computer magazines talking about the terrible things that happen to their floppy disks, right? And so whether it's they're being used as frisbees or they're chewed up by dogs or, I spilled ice cream all over, you know, you're just imagining, like, how did your floppy disk even get in this situation? And so it really tells a story of the kind of really practical use of computing equipment at the level of the household, right? That is something that I really wanted to capture in that chapter.
And that's, yeah, I like that cultural angle on the fragility of the medium. We've talked a lot about that on RCR too. Those of us who grew up in that period, we still have to this day, like a PTSD about magnets. Like all of us are just hyper aware of where all the speakers are in a room. And as a retro computing enthusiast, it's actually a problem because now that we don't have that problem anymore, there's mixed magnets everywhere. So like the lid on my AirPods charging case has a magnet in it. So, and we don't think about them. So you're using your AirPods while you're playing with your Apple II, you set your charging case down and you just ruined your 40-year-old copy of something. Like it's almost harder nowadays because there's just magnets everywhere because people stopped worrying about them.
Yeah, in some ways I was really disinterested in the like, is it okay to break copy protection or not? I was like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, what's interesting is reading this as a like historical problem, which is why did this matter? And like why it mattered was because of this, you were trying to get people to understand or to just be able to make use of this entirely new category of media. The section in like the Apple DOS handbook about the moral of the story of, you know, back up your floppy disk and stuff like that. It tells you so much about how little people understood about their computers and how really instructive and almost pedagogic, these companies had to be with folks. And yeah. I think we talk a lot about copy breaking. We explain very little how copy protection actually works. I found it a lot. It was very hard to actually understand, wait, what is copy protection at the like material level? So I did do a lot of research, got some help from some Apple II hackers whose names I don't even know. They're just listed by their Twitter handle in the footnotes and in the source material, who kind of vetted some of my explanations to make sure I was technically correct.
Yeah, we have 4 a.m. in the stream, in this stream chat right now. Yeah,
yep. Yeah, it would be 4 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Locksmith is a great test case for this also because it's a great industry story as well. They were notorious for playing both sides. They sold DRM protection to the software companies while simultaneously selling the breaking software to consumers, to hardcore consumers. So they were kind of notorious for that, playing both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that it was interesting to sort of read the Locksmith chapter and be reminded that, like, it was a big part of my life. Like, you know, like this, everybody I talked to knew this, had this, used it. You know, I was well aware of it. But it's true that I'm coming at that from a different angle, and it isn't. I can see that the general, even computing aware world, wouldn't know about this. You know, there's hardcore computists and you know, some specialized magazines for this, and you hear about it on the sort of subversive BBSs and things. Yeah. But
well, and like Lane said, it's interesting because it was such a fundamental piece of software at the time. You had to use something like that, Locksmith, Copy2+, etc. And nowadays, that's just a non-thing. It was a crucial solution to a problem that no longer exists. And it's hard to overstate how important that was to computing at the time.
Yeah, because we don't get to own our software anymore, by and large.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We exist in this world of cloud-based software platforms. It was a very careful chapter I had to write because I was like, oh, yeah, I have to, like, un-engineer for you this idea of the relationship between software and hardware, which, like, lots of people who've never really thought about how computers work wouldn't even necessarily know how to articulate a distinction about that in the present.
Yeah. Yeah, even the line between software and hardware has gotten blurrier. Like, it's funny, software's fallen into two camps in the modern age. Either it's so valuable that you only get to rent it, like Adobe, or it's so worthless that you download it for free and you know, like the apps on your phone.
Yeah.
There's nothing in the middle. It isn't like doesn't have the aura of professional product that it did there in the 80s and 90s, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it is interesting that people, you know, people looking back on this when they didn't live through it might not actually be aware that, you know, so you can run software on a computer that is not connected to a network.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and the whole notion that moving data used to be hard, right? Like, we had to have special Locksmith programs, and we had to have special, like, you had to have juggling multiple disks, and, like, moving data is something that's so automatic now, it's just like breathing, you don't even think about it. But that used to be hard. You spent a lot of your time working on that. Like, if you had to shift files from one disk to another, that was a project. You know, it took you an hour or so to organize that to happen. So I think that's another thing you'd have to explain, maybe, in a book like this.
Yeah, that, you know, software is not a thing that you download, that these computers, right, don't even have hard drives, right? So so to remember that floppy disks were originally understood as, like, memory, not as, like, it was slightly different than, like, storage, right? And you know, I teach 18 to 22-year-olds, right? They have no idea what a file system is because that has been eradicated from their use of a computer. Everything just lives in the cloud, and when you want to find it, you try and search for it, and there's just no idea of, like, that, like, nesting things used to actually have a physical reality to, like, where the file is. You know, it's a little maddening teaching history of computing to young folks is like a real encounter with everything you don't even realize you know, right? Yeah.
Adding to what Paul was saying, you know, right, you don't download it. And what we've all been saying, you don't download it. I remember, like, versioning, you know, like, I remember I bought, like, music instruction set for the Apple II, and I bought it because, oh, I went out and bought this sound box that came out, like the Cricut device. And of course, the version of music instruction set I had didn't support it yet, you know, and so it's not like you could just, it's going to update itself on the internet. I remember putting it in the mail, mailing it to Electronic Arts, and then 3 weeks later, you know, they shipped me the version. You know, this is all, it never was the internet or any kind of network or phone line can, you know, touching any of this. And you physically, I had a reason to need that update, so I had to go mail it, you know, but often, usually you didn't get the update because, you know, it wasn't available and you didn't have a driving need for it. It's just very, so very different.
Yeah. I mean, this is what letters to the editor sections of, you know, particularly magazines like Soft Talk were full of. It was just this kind of, like, world of complaint, world of incompatibility, everyone just sort of kind of tearing their hair out about, like, what should work but doesn't work, and why doesn't oh, my column board work with my word processor, and that doesn't work with my printer, and it's like almost wild that computing even happened, right? When you look at just the sheer level of difficulty that was required to get a non-technical, non-programming user to be able to acclimate to these kinds of systems. It was incredibly challenging, and had a really, you know, computing has such a slower on-ramp of integration into the domestic space versus technologies like radio or television, which basically mm-hmm. took like about a decade to be in 80% of homes or more. You know, computing doesn't reach those thresholds really until the 21st century.
That's a good point. Yeah, the barrier to entry in computing was very, very high. Again, that's something that we all take for granted. But yeah, I mean, when we got a printer and we got Print Shop, to reference your cover again, we spent an entire day fiddling with it before we got something to print, like, because we couldn't figure out which driver to use, because Print Shop has 200 drivers built into it, and our printer was some off-brand clone of some other off-brand, and we didn't know, there was no specific driver for it. So we literally went through and tried every single driver in the Print Shop list, and we found one that worked. But it took an entire day, and who would do that if you didn't really, really love this toy and really believed in it, you know, because there was no, yeah, who's got time for that?
One of your last chapters here is on the education software. And it was interesting just because I sort of always knew that there was a heavy business angle on it, you know, it's really a lot of why we have as much as we have is because people thought they could make money doing that. You know, it isn't all altruism. but it was an interesting take.
No altruism, I would argue. You know, after like 79, like, I just don't really think altruism is even in the system in many cases. But sorry, go on.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, I guess, you know, that's one of the things that people feel like is the selling point of computers. Well, at least, you know, it'll help your kid learn. You know, it'll be just more efficient. They will learn it better, whatever. But it does really seem like it's largely just corporations trying to sell snake oil to schools.
it kind of was, right? Like, we had Apple II labs in junior high school because, again, back to that idea, everyone kind of knew computers were going to be a thing, so we better teach them to the kids. But nobody really knew what to do, right? So they taught us basic programming and stuff because they didn't really know what to teach us about these things. But we had a room full of them that some corporation sold the school board, so we better use them. In hindsight, it was all a little bit silly.
I mean, yeah, there's some really great histories of how the American school system has been subject over and over again, over more than a century, to this idea that bringing new technology into a school is going to enhance, improve, enable, and or kind of just magically make better learning. When we have almost every bit of evidence to the contrary of that. And this happening in the 70s/80s is really significant because it's this moment that America as a nation is trying to reckon with a new status of no longer being the greatest industrial power in the world. And so there's, you know, on top of that, you have, you know, the recessions and oil crisis of the 1970s and 80s. You have all of this unemployment. There was this real sense that, like, our economy doesn't work anymore. And so how do we shore that up? How do we save it? What about the children, right? And the computer, the personal computer emerged as this, or was, I would argue, put forth by those who had financial interests as a solution to many of these things, right? And so there's this idea that, well, you have to have a computer in your school because that's what it means to make sure our children can be competitive, particularly with Japan. There was a huge amount of Japanophobia underlying a lot of this, right? Was that we didn't want to lose our computer competitive edge to the Japanese. And so suddenly we have computer labs and nobody actually knows what to do with them, right? That are full of Apple IIs, you know, and so they just give us the Oregon Trail for all of the, you know, nominal historical value of that game, you know, like the education chapter where, you know, also that market is so different. There's companies that made products just to sell to schools. And that's a very particular kind of mode of industry production that I kind of don't deal with. But I'm looking at, what about companies that were doing quote-unquote educational products, but for a home consumer market? So this is a really appealing to anxious parents who are concerned precisely about these factors, right? That like, oh, well, I guess if we put a computer in front of a kid, something magical will happen, right? Inherently, yeah. Just because they're exposed to it. And the education chapter is really the one where you see that the economic and financial motivations are just the baldest, right? Spinnaker is a company that is created in a boardroom before it ever has a product, right? It's like financed before anyone has programmed anything. It has nothing to do with knowledge of the market, with skill, with programming, with an interest in these. It's like purely a land grab, right? I think it shows the kind of financial motivations that are underwriting all of this development better, probably best out of all of the five chapters. So it was convenient it was the last one as well, because I thought it really like rang a bell in terms of my larger argument about computing's kind of it's really important to recognize its ties to a new emergent economy, I think, during this time.
And that home educational software was I'm sure was the grease on the wheels of the machine, because the kids wanted the computers, but the parents were paying for them. And the parents, there was a real moral panic about them, you know, is my kid just going to play games and rot their brain? So, you know, it allowed the parents to feel good about themselves to buy this computer if they also bought Rocky's boots and Snooper Troops with it. And then the kid was just going to go, you know, play Ultima anyway. But yeah, I think that we all had one of those Spinnaker boxes on our shelves that our parents or our grandparents bought for us. And that was what allowed the machine to be in the house, kind of thing. It was like a moral permission for the parents to buy this thing, maybe.
It rationalized and also made safe, I think, this idea of computing, right? In the, that it made it, it was one of the ways that it became personal, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, despite whatever led to these things being created, there are some pretty amazing ones out there. I mean, like, so they, some of them are better than they had to be. You know, it's not that it turned out to be shovelware entirely, but
A lot of the Spinnaker stuff, I mean, In Search of the Most Amazing Thing is an incredible piece of software. It really is. If you dive into all of the lessons that it teaches you about navigation and stock markets and cultural interaction, and yeah, it's a pretty amazing thing that didn't need to exist. Like you said, it didn't need to be as good as it was.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Snyder was an incredibly, you know, brilliant man. It was sheer luck that he was the guy who got put together with the Spinnaker executives to make product for them, right? They had no way of evaluating his competency, right? That was a marriage brokered by their venture capitalist, because he taught her son. At a like private school in Massachusetts, outside of Boston.
That's a great example too of how ad hoc all of this was. Like, again, we look back on history as being this inevitable logical progression, but no, it was just a bunch of hippies and tech nerds just throwing things at the wall, and it's
billionaires and venture capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. A lot of different invested parties, right? Yeah. I mean, Snyder was he was like a kind of self-entrepreneur, right? He was a musician, he was a programmer, he was a teacher, he was a lovely guy to talk to, actually. He was a real delight to interview.
Well, Paul, should we move on with some news items, or what's next on the agenda here?
Yeah, I suppose we could do that. So what we usually do is, we talk about, you know, sort of like whatever we happen to have seen in the past, you know, since we recorded last. So Lane, I don't know if you wanted to hang out and continue to talk with us about those, or.
Yeah, I'll hang out for a bit.
Sure. Okay. So Blake, you have the first news item.
Yeah, I just have the one, actually. We've talked a lot about the Vid HD card for the Apple, for the slotted Apple IIs that, sits in the slot, and it monitors what's happening on the bus, and it recreates the basically the video display, what's happening in video memory on the card, and it outputs it to HDMI. So you have a digital output, and it has various effects. And it actually goes, the VidHD on the side also does a lot of other things. It has, you know, non-standard high text modes. It's very versatile. But anyway, there's a simpler device. And actually, the VidHD right now is not in production because I think I saw a discussion on the Slack indicating that some of the parts are not available and or too expensive right now, so it's on hold whether or not it ever gets reintroduced. But someone is working on it's Lucazi, and I actually don't know more about this individual.
It's Alex. Yeah,
we've talked about him quite a bit. Yeah, he does a lot of projects like this. Yeah.
Okay, so assuming we have not talked about this, basically this is using a Raspberry Pi Pico device to do basically the same thing. It sits in a slot, it monitors what's happening, and it generates a reproduction of the video situation, and it outputs it, to a modern output. And so that's it's in progress. It looks like he's sharing. There's a video linked on the website. He's sharing some schematics, but I don't think there's any clear indication as to whether it will be sold at this point. But it's something to keep an eye on. It looks like it would probably be, if it were sold or if you were going to build it yourself, it would probably be a little less expensive than the arguably more capable VidHD, which is not presently available. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that, as it seems like something that many people might be interested in.
This kind of thing always seemed like the promise of things like the Pico, that it's like a little cheap thing that does mainly what you need for video. I don't know, are they easily available? I mean, like the Raspberry Pi is generally all dried up as well, but I don't know if this one did.
I think the Pico, I don't think they are easily acquired. I think you can, I think you're going to probably go on eBay and pay more. It's constrained. I think that's the case across all of Raspberry Pi, and of course now there are a lot of competitors. I know it's interesting. I don't know about the Pico. I think the Pico is used in one, but I know we talk sometimes. I know you got your own not long ago, Quinn. I think the Amiga. There are several accelerator solutions basically that emulate the 68000 at a very high speed, or they're emulating a 6820 and you can scale it, and they're basically a CPU socket interface to a Raspberry Pi device with some sort of bridge hardware and the ability to go in and upgrade it and tweak things. And so it's been very popular as an accelerator on the Amiga, and it makes sense, I guess, to see it serving in this capacity. I mean, it could easily be a 65816 accelerator on a GS. If there's not already a Raspberry Pi device that does that, I honestly can't say that there is or isn't. But so it seems it's just basically software, and
the short answer is that Pi availability varies a lot. Sometimes they're easy to get and sometimes they disappear. The complexities of post-COVID supply chains, I guess. I'm guessing the VidHD, so the VidHD is based on an Orange Pi, and I'm guessing that that might be the piece they're having trouble getting right now. I don't want to speak out of turn there, but that might be the same thing.
All right, let's see. So Jordan Mechner of Karateka, you would say. I would say Karateka, I don't know. Some people would say it some other way.
He would say Karateka, I believe, yes.
Yeah.
We all say Karateka, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Karateka.
Anyway, also Prince of Persia, and, that's how that's that Jordan Mechner. He has released a graphic novel called Replay, and it is currently only in French, but in March 2024 it will be available in English. And he did a book signing in France, and some of the Apple II France community went and got signed copies and things. It was kind of neat. But anyway, I think we know that he's very into sort of like cinematic storytelling and that sort of thing. And I think this is sort of continuing on that line. Also previously, he'd published sort of like development notes, I think of, both Prince of Persia and of Karateka, for, sort of reading along as those were put together. But, anyway, I thought this was not particularly vintage computing related, although it does, you know, show on the cover someone using an Apple II. So
this certainly was unexpected. He's a very creative guy. I would not have predicted this as his next move, though. So that's pretty cool.
All right. Let's see. Quinn, I guess you have the next thing in the notes.
I do, yeah. This is still, it's very early days to be talking about this yet, but I feel more morally obligated to do so because there is, in fact, a new 2GS emulator on the way, which that's like, yeah, return of insert your favorite religious figure here. I mean, new 2GS emulators are just, it just doesn't happen. I mean, every single 2GS emulator out there currently is based on what are the two big ones? Bernie to the Rescue or Kegs? We're gonna get email. But anyway, there's two major GS emulation cores that were written like 20 years ago, and every single 2GS emulator is based on one or the other. Most of them are a fork of the code base of one or the other, and they're all fine. They mostly work, but they all have various niggling details. None of them are perfect, and which is not a slight on the people building and maintaining those. It's a very, very difficult platform to emulate, as we've talked a lot about on the show. There's a lot of tricky memory timing with the shadowing and little cycles getting dropped here and there, and the vertical blank is complicated, and the border scan timing is complicated, and if you don't emulate it all just perfectly, nothing, you know, little things don't work. Like, I've never seen a GS emulator that does the border scrolling text in the FTA Christmas demo exactly right. It's perfectly readable on real hardware, and it's not quite readable in any of the emulators. So, point being, very difficult platform to emulate. But here is another person coming along to throw his hat in the ring. It's called CrossRunner, and it's very early yet. The GitHub just went up. Ken wrote about it over on A2Central, and there's some very impressive video of it running. We'll link to Ken's write-up about it, but it's not... It's a ways from being ready yet, so I think first release is anticipated in 2023, but I wanted to write about it now, or talk about it now, because it's very exciting, and hopefully the author is listening and will be enthused to finish it, because the world needs better and more and better 2GS emulation. This one is Windows only, unfortunately, so that's going to be a barrier for some, myself included, unfortunately, but I'm just excited that someone is writing a new core for 2GS emulation, because as I said, this apparently is a brand new core. He's starting from scratch, as far as I can tell, and aiming for, it's listed as being cycle accurate. Now, what that actually means on the GS is a little fuzzy. Emulating the 65816 cycle accurate is one thing, but getting, again, all of the weird wait states and cycles that are in the memory systems and so on is a little more, there's a lot more going on, but yeah, screenshots and videos of it are very impressive. He's got real-time displays of the Ensoniq registers and all of the, you know, the, lots of cool debugging tools like Virtual 2 has for. So this could be a really powerful software writing tool for the GS. And we'll know that he's emulated the Ensoniq properly if it has annoying click sounds whenever you swap instruments in and out. That's a little insider joke for the GS people.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, I think there is some, if you want to sort of like keep up on development of that, there is some discussion in the Slack, the, what is it called? Apple II Infinitum Slack.
Infinitum.
Yeah, information on this was really hard to find. Like, the GitHub really has nothing on it right now. There's just like a blank README that's waiting to be filled in, and the repo exists. Yeah, really the most info I could find on it was Ken's write-up, which is itself necessarily sparse because there's not a lot about it out there yet. But yeah, the video, you can watch the video of it running the Nucleus demo, which is fantastic, and it seems to be running extremely well. So that's really encouraging.
My thing was to just mention something that is that came and went, basically, you know, between the last episode and this one. So we talked a little bit about there being months that people did stuff. So Doscember, you know, people would do things, and March and Tosh, and you know, the Apple II people thought, well, we should maybe have one for the Apple II. And so on something like April 3rd or something like that, this was broadcast as, you know, this is April 2. So it is the Apple Apple events in April.
Yeah, it's a little rough.
Yeah, it hurts a little bit.
Yeah, but I think the idea is essentially, it's probably a little bit like, it's like the other named months, you know, where you're supposed to just try to do something fun and write it up, make videos or work on projects and then tag them and they'll get collected in some way on some link sites. So I didn't do a thing about this, but it's interesting that it happened, and it will probably continue to happen in future Aprils. I think April was, apart from the kind of way that you can mash Apple into it, it also is the incorporation of Apple was April 1st, so that's potentially relevant.
What's the Tandy one that we're supposed to mention every year, and then we forget? Is it Septandy or?
Septandy.
Oh, yes.
Tandyvember or something. Okay.
Yeah, I should know the incorporation of Apple. It's definitely in the book.
Yeah, something happened on April 1st. Some large Apple event.
I think September might be the Septam Coupe month.
I hope so. I hope that is what ends up happening.
Anyway.
Nabuvember.
All right, we got our Sam Coupe and our Naboo reference for the show, so now we just have to talk about Carrington's Canadian girlfriend, and we've got a bingo.
That's right. Anyway, yeah, so next April, plan ahead and do something Apple II related for April 2.
In all seriousness, though, it's nice that people do stuff like that just to keep the community talking and doing stuff. Nothing bad about that, except maybe the portmanteaus. Those are bad, but
right.
The spirit is nice.
So actually, the one thing that I was thinking of putting in there as a news item instead was something that was sent to us in feedback, I think, by Tony, just pointing out the existence of this BitC128 video DAC for Commodore 128. So I didn't initially understand what this was. This is sort of in the video solutions for old computers category, but it isn't actually, it's not exactly a video solution. It's like a bridge to a video solution. So the Commodore 128 had digital video, and this thing will turn it into analog that you can feed into another solution. So you can compare this with a Gonbus solution or some such thing. But so this is specifically usable for the Commodore 128. This also works on the CGA for the PC. And I wondered actually if this would also be a solution for the Apple IIgs and Apple III also, because I think they're also digital RGB.
So the 2GS is arcade video. That's the weird thing about it. So it's 15 kilohertz horizontal scan arcade video. It's actually analog RGB. I don't like to use that word RGB because that's not actually a video standard. That doesn't actually mean anything. There are a million ways to break a video signal up and recombine it into three channels. But yeah, so the easiest way to think about 2GS and Amiga video is that it's arcade video. It's the same standard that arcade machines used, which was a 15 kilohertz. And then it depends on whether you sync on green or you sync on vertical blank or, there's various ways to do the syncing. But anyway.
But so this piece, if you had a Commodore 128 and you wanted to get it out VGA or if you have some sort of HDMI adapter or something like that, you can get this little bridge and then you get whatever it was that you were going to use anyway to make your VGA or HDMI, and then you put the two together.
It's amazing how we're, decades into this hobby and we're still coming up with new video solutions. We've got two or three in this show already alone. We talk about some kind of video solution every single show. Like, it's such a fundamental issue with trying to get these old machines to run again.
Okay, Quinn, you have other news items, I see.
I do, yeah. So I'm going to share for the stream this YouTube video about the Sol 20. This is a machine that we've talked about a fair bit on the show because it was a very, very early all-in-one plug-and-play home computer. Predates the Apple II, I believe. We'll get email, I'm sure, if I'm wrong about that, but what's cool about this video is that it's the first time I've ever seen a working one being demonstrated. You know, this is the kind of machine that we've all seen pictures of. It's the blue sheet metal case with the wood sides and the logo that looks like it's scrolling past. It's a very nice looking machine. But it's the kind of thing you see a million pictures of, but you never actually see it working. So this YouTuber who goes by Action Retro has got his hands on one, and it's a beautiful example. It's just flawless, this thing. It's not even dirty. It's, I don't know where he got it from. Maybe he says in the video, but what's cool about it is he goes through, he actually demonstrates using it. He runs some software on it, demonstrates stuff, it doing stuff, and then he goes and takes it apart, and he goes through all of the internals and, you know, takes you through all the boards and stuff that are inside the machine, the power supply and everything. So it's a real deep dive on a machine that most of us have only ever seen pictures of. So I thought it was worth sharing with the audience. Fair warning, this fellow has a strong case of YouTube voice. So turn your volume down because you are going to get yelled at from second one of this video. But otherwise, it's great. He's very excited. If you like that YouTube energy, he's got lots of that. But yeah, it's a neat tour of a machine that most of us will probably never see in action.
That's beautiful. That's great to know about. It's 76 is when the Soul comes out.
Ah, there you go. So we have our live fact checker, which is good. Usually we rely on our streaming audience to tell us we're wrong about things, so it's handy to have a co-host doing it.
More of the same year as the Apple One board.
Ah, okay, yeah.
But this is, I think, the first time you see the form factor that is based on the TV terminal as like the form that winds up becoming what all of the 77 Trinity become, which is this idea that a computer is now, or that a microcomputer is a keyboard with a monitor.
Yeah, and it's neat in that way because it's so ahead of its time. Like, it was a very prescient thing. I think that, so this, the name comes from the guy's name who invented it, Nick Solomon or something, his name.
I think it was Les Solomon, and he worked with Lee Felsenstein, who's like infamous for the Osborne and for homebrew computer stuff. So they collaborated on it.
Yeah, because like you said, until then, computers were just bare boards. If you could, the Apple One, and then before that, you had things like the Altair, which were kits. So this idea of coming up with this form factor and then selling it as an assembled unit was a pretty prescient idea. It's impressive that it came from these two fellows that nobody's probably heard of.
I wish Earl were here. I believe when I was listening to his podcast, the first retro computing or podcast of any sort that I ever began listening to, I think he had an early episode that was entirely about the Sol. I feel like I remember that's the case. I'm sure he would have had some interesting input, but he could not join us today.
And these machines like this are interesting too, because these are the extreme case of what Lane was talking about earlier, where it's like, okay, you buy this thing and now what do you do with it? Because these things had no software at all, zero. So you were literally...
There's nothing resembling a commercial software market. I mean, even though the form factor is quote unquote friendlier, you're still stuck programming everything yourself, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, just a real nightmare from a usability standpoint.
Yeah, I imagine the few people that bought this would have just been poking at it occasionally, writing a little hello world, and then it sits on your workbench for a couple of months, and then you come back to it and do it all over again. It's not something that would have been productive in any way that we would recognize.
So it's certainly not running something. For some reason, I was assuming it was running an early version of CPM or something like that, but no, I guess not.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know if the Sol even had storage, to be honest.
There was a patch that allowed CPM to... Oh, no, that might be wrapped up in North Star. No, I don't think it had... No.
Hmm. No. Well, I mean, yeah, I'll have to watch the video. It sounds very interesting. I have not watched this video.
Yeah, I mean, CPM, I think the baseline for that is disk storage of some sort, right? I mean, this thing maybe had a tape drive, if that, but I don't think it had much for storage. Yeah, this is very much still in the Altair model of turn it on, key in your bootloader, and then write something to blink lights, and then look at it and pat yourself on the back, and then put it away again. That's about all you were going to do with this machine, I think.
That makes the earlier discussion of the antiquated Apple II software delivery model seem rather modern by comparison.
It does. I mean, quite. again, going back to the main thesis of Lane's book, which is that the revolution of computing was very much the invention of the software industry. Like, that's what gave shape and form to computers as a useful appliance. And this all is a perfect example of what happens when you don't have that, when you only have the first half of the equation. Here's this amazing piece of hardware that by all accounts is beautiful and perfectly designed, but it's useless without the entire industry of software on the other side of it. All right, so I just wanted to share that. So that is the end of that news item. Do you want me to do my other one too, Paul?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see, this is a little bonus item. This came up on Hackaday recently. It's a very funny modern story of computing, in a sense, with a retro twist. It turns out that in like the 90s, there was a bustling embedded systems market that was based around system-on-chip devices. And so these SoC chips that were essentially like an 8088, an XT, or a 386 PC system-on-chip. And they were put in washing machines, you know, appliances, industrial control modules, whatever. Things that needed an embedded system that was well understood by programmers. They were using these 386 and x86 cores. And now, 20 years later, there's these companies in China that for some reason, nobody's quite sure why, they are recycling these appliances and these control modules and so on, stripping out the system-on-chip unit from them, putting them back into these little handhelds with an LCD screen, a modern LCD, and a little keyboard in a little injection molded case, and reselling them as retro modern DOS PCs. So you can buy these things with dubiously legal copies of Windows installed on them, no doubt defaulting to Mandarin or something along those lines, but they are full-blown XT or AT DOS PCs with VGA that could be quite a good retro computing platform if you're, you know, a golden era DOS age gamer, you know, VGA Sound Blaster 486 kind of era DOS gamer. These things could be a lot of fun for that. It's kind of like a modern version of the Atari portfolio, you know, a surprisingly contemporary, powerful little machine in a very compact package. So the Hackaday article goes through these things, and basically the tone of it is, why does this exist? Nobody knows. Nobody understands why some company in China is going to all the trouble to make these things, but they are, and you can buy them on AliExpress right now. So it's the kind of thing that a bunch of people are going to buy and try to figure out what you might be able to do with it. I'm sure the supply of them is limited because they are literally recycling components. Oh, see, there you go. I just clicked on the AliExpress link and this item is no longer available. So maybe they're already gone. They were neat. They had Sound Blaster support in them and everything. So I guess the supply of recycled chips ran out, so they're not making them anymore. But yeah, a funny artifact of the global economy of the modern age.
The device, it's interesting, the device on the video stream here, we're looking at the Hackaday page, and the image pictured looks very much like some of the, back in the early 90s, or the mid-90s, there were vertical market, you know, like industrial little handheld computers with like a scanner attached, and they look, the form factor seems very much like that. I thought that's where you were going with this at first.
I know the things you mean. Yeah, they would have been running like Windows CE or store kiosks. So, you know, it would have been the same hardware in those. But this is running Windows 95, and they seem to be. It's a new board that they've built, and a new case and everything. But nobody knows why. So I hope they come back actually, because it's kind of a neat artifact. It's possible that they exist in some other listing on AliExpress. I haven't dug into this, so maybe you can still get them. But the link that Hackaday has is now broken. I wonder if the XT one works. Let's try that real quick. Nope, no longer available. Yeah, so the XT one was actually a notebook form factor that had CGA.
Have they shown up on eBay yet for a resale?
That's a good question. I would not be shocked. I would not be shocked if they do.
By the way, Santo in our chat tells us that the Solitone had a Helios 2 dual 8-inch drive option, also by processor technology. So
okay, cool. And,
I definitely heard of Helios 2 now that I read that.
But, well, imagine what that cost in 1976, a dual 8-inch floppy drive. Oof. Probably you could buy 10 Sol-20s for what that accessory cost.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for my news items.
Yep, and I think that's it for the news items as well. So I guess we could say, and now a word from our sponsor.
In January of this year at the Consumer Electronics Show, we introduced a product that we call the Timex Sinclair 2000. Many of you probably read about this in trade magazines, and an equal number of you probably today are asking yourself, what happened to the TS2000 product? To back up just a second, Timex and Sinclair have a relationship whereby our company has the rights to Sinclair technology exclusively for the North American continent, and Sinclair had introduced a product called the Spectrum in the UK, and this product has been very, very successful there. By the end of December, he expects to have sold over 1 million of the Spectrum units in his marketing territory. We introduced a product which was our version of the Spectrum. Basically, we had changed the case styling and made two or three other minor changes, but our intent was to introduce exactly the same product. The difficulty in introducing products in the U.S. versus the U.K. is that in the U.K. you don't have to contend with the FCC. Here in the U.S., of course, we have to have our products qualified by the FCC, and after introducing that product, it was determined that in order to qualify the product for the FCC, it was going to be necessary for Timex to have a completely customized chip, which was going to take about 6 months for us to get turned. Over that period of time, we thought we could make several enhancements to the product, which you're going to see demonstrated here tonight. And I think by the end of the evening, I hope you will agree that the enhancements that we've made have certainly been worth the wait. We've made enhancements to the original product that Sinclair and Timex introduced as a 2000. Among these enhancements included bank switching architecture, it included high-resolution color graphics, it included the ability to display 64 characters on the screen, it included the capability of using solid-state ROM software, it included a full-scale, full-travel keyboard, electronic-style keyboard, and we feel that all these things in conjunction with the fact that we're supporting three monitors, a color television set, a composite video monitor, as well as an RGB monitor. Before we give you a demonstration on the 2068, I'd like to also talk about another product that we introduced at retail starting the first week of September. This is the Timex Sinclair 1500. The Timex Sinclair 1500 is a monochrome computer. We've targeted this product specifically to the educational marketplace. It has 16K of memory on board and is capable of being expanded to 32K, and we've designed all of our products so that the peripherals can be used up and down the line. I mentioned earlier that there are four markets that we feel that are either here or emerging. The first two of these markets being literacy and education, the second being entertainment, the third being home management, and the fourth being the productivity in the home type of applications. And it's to all four of these that we're targeting the 2068.
If you'd like to know what experts are saying about the new Apple IIgs, we'll translate.
It's got a 32-voice sound chip for digital synthesis.
256K on the motherboard with 1 meg expansion.
Hey, check out this RGB color with super high res.
Told you, 16-bit processor with 2.8 meg clock speed.
The Apple IIgs.
It's a machine, huh?
Simply speaking, the most powerful Apple II made.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retrocomputing gift idea this time actually isn't it isn't really retrocomputing related. It is just retro, but it is a candlestick phone. I was curious about this to see if you could get these, and they do sell. This particular one is a Opus 1921 Cable C candlestick retro telephone, and it's selling for $145, so it's not it's not super cheap, but apparently it so it has a little rotary dial thing, it has the candlestick thing that you talk into and the thing you hold up to your ear. It apparently does actually use DTMF you know, so you spin the thing with your finger and then it dials three or whatever.
So it makes the tones in response to.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it does work. It still takes you a long time to dial, you know, 1-800 anything.
You still hate all the people that had nines and zeros in their phone numbers. Yeah,
that's right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, it seemed like it was a kind of a neat item. The thing
about these items seems to always be that they're smaller than you think they will be. Like these modern retro products, you always get them and they're like 60% real size or something, because that makes them cheaper, and they want to, if they sell it for, if it's too expensive, nobody will buy it, so they have to scale it down.
Yeah. I wonder if it's the case that in any, because I know there's like most, quote, you know, home phones now or some sort of a VoIP situation tied to cable or something. I know ours is now, but I think you can still get like a POTS telephone line if you want to pay for that, I believe, in most areas. Do we know, would the old multiple pulse actual rotary dial signal work? Like, does that still work in a POTS system or no?
Depends on the area. I think I'm not aware of any areas where rotary dial phones are still work. It's like analog TV. Like there was a moment where they officially just shut it off and said, this doesn't work anymore. So I don't imagine they do. Because the payphone trick stopped working somewhere in like the mid 90s. You used to be able to dial a payphone just by flicking the cradle, because the switch, the cradle switch is actually the same switch inside the phone that makes the pulses, to the relay pulses. So you could dial from payphones without paying for it, but that stopped working in like 94 or something.
Okay. So yeah, I missed the memo on that, but thinking about it, yeah, it makes sense that wouldn't work any longer.
Interesting. It hadn't occurred to me that it might stop working, but yeah, I did that. I it wasn't for payphone purposes. It was just kind of, you know, amusing myself. I would call friends by like just banging on the switch hook.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, it was emulated, like, from, like, the 70s through the 90s, rotary dial was being emulated on the far end. Because, of course, originally the reason for the rotary dial was that those pulses were actually clicking forward a series of relays that formed, like, a shift register on the exchange side. So it was a direct electrical connection between your phone and the relays on the switchboard. But they took, when they got rid of mechanical relays, of course, that mechanism was broken. So they had to detect the pulses and then fake it on their end. So that had been fake already for like 25 years when they finally shut them off. So, yeah. And now, of course, it's all fake again because it's still a landline on our side. But it's, again, now it's all VoIP on their end. But again, they have to fake it because your old touch tone phone will still work, but it's expecting certain things, like it gets a 35 or whatever it is volt pulse to ring the phone, for example, on that line. But that has to be faked because, again, on their side, it's just IP packets now. So they have to fake the voltages and stuff closer to your end of the line.
So one of the things that led me to pick this was, I remember we were talking about the Carter phone as being a 1966 thing that was a radio bridge. This, for some reason, I think it was in the discussion of this, I was made aware of the Hushaphone. This is from the 1920s, I guess. It's a thing that you put over your candlestick phone so that you can talk into it without people being able to hear you. Which is pretty excellent. And so that's kind of why I wanted the candlestick thing, was so that, you know, you could actually, it was something that you could actually put a Hushaphone on. There's a $600 Hushaphone on eBay if you wanted to get it. But it's pretty cool.
Why is it that shape? Do we know? Is it something to do with eliminating echoes or something?
Yeah, it has to be acoustic, right? The bell shape is, probably an echo reduction technique.
Yeah, I wonder how it sounds. Like, I wonder if you can hear the difference. Probably you can if you're listening to somebody talking through a Hushaphone. But maybe it is actually supposed to amplify it, because you'll be talking quietly into it.
Not sure. It comes with sound absorption units that go into the ends of it. So they're like soft rubber pads or something.
Oh. So that's, yeah, controlling echo or something.
Maybe, yeah. Because maybe the idea is it's just a box that you're talking into, so it catches the sound. Like, I guess you're supposed to put your mouth directly up to that thing, which seems a little awkward and weird. But then once you've done that, now you're talking into a metal can, which is going to sound terrible. So they probably had to then cancel out the reverb of the metal can that your mouth is sitting on.
I put in the chat a link to a JPEG of someone using it in what seems like it might be the 1930s or something.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. It is just as ridiculous as I had hoped.
I think I've seen this photo, but yes.
That is the greatest photo we've ever had on the stream, I think. That is pretty fantastic.
I guess it makes you feel important, right?
Yeah.
Like my conversation is too important for you to hear.
Amazing.
All right. So if you wanted to get a candlestick phone, there's only, as far as I know, the one Hushaphone on eBay, but you can get your own candlestick phone in preparation for when the next one comes up. And now I guess we can move to the eBay auctions, and Blake, you have the first one.
Yes. I was just, I think I have one item, and it is the Timex Sinclair 1500, which is what it is. People may remember the Timex Sinclair 1000 computer, which was a basic, you know, black and white. What was it? $99, I think, is what it cost at the time. Simple, you know, computer. Early on, I think it was like 81 it was released. Anyway, the auction today is a the 1500. It was released as a stopgap before the release of the Timex 2068, which was basically the 2068 was going to be a competitor with more modern systems. It was a Sinclair ZX Spectrum, which was very popular in Britain, but it was brought in America, and of course they, for some reason, you know, changed ROM location, so it didn't actually run the ZX Spectrum software, but there's cartridges that make it work. But anyway, this is a stopgap between the 1000 and the 2068, and I think it had 16K of RAM instead of 2K or whatever the Timex had. And the reason I caught my attention was grabbed by this was it's a pretty rare unit. There aren't many of them. It's black and white. It's just basically an expanded Timex Sinclair 1000 with the ZX Spectrum case, but it comes with a cassette recorder, Timex 2020, and it's sort of in a nice little I like the package that it presents here. It's in a briefcase with foam cutouts for the power supplies, you know, cartridge, the tape unit, and it's just on the outside. It's a regular briefcase, and it just seemed an interesting, clean-looking, altogether kit if you happen to be into the very obscure American, Timex Sinclair systems from the early 80s, and It seemed like a nice altogether package in very good condition, and it's kind of an interesting oddity. The total package was interesting to me.
I think the cassette drive is the start of the show there. That's a sweet little cassette drive. I wonder, that must not
it
be very,
very
common.
Nice.
Like, that's probably rarer than the computer is, honestly. Is that it's actually Timex Sinclair branded, which is
Timex Sinclair 2020. And it's a very attractive cassette player. It matches the color of the silver, and of course it has the, I'm sure it's just a standard cassette in out cable, right, to the Timex. But yeah, it looks like just a clean unit. It's a nice total package that I had someone gave me a Timex Sinclair 1000 back in the mid-80s, and I played around with it a bit. It was as rough to use as you can imagine. I don't know if anyone else has had the pleasure.
But yeah, you got what you paid for with that one.
Yeah. I think it was a joke. People, it makes a good doorstop. I did end up using it as a doorstop for the room that I kept my computers in when I was a teenager. So, yeah. But, anyway, it caught my attention, perhaps oddly. But, and it was the price on that one was $300. And there was a little bit of time left. So, anyway. There you go.
Yeah, that's my pick. So yeah, the Tonic Sinclair 1000 is the basically North American equivalent of the ZX81.
Right.
So,
and it has the same case as the ZX81. Yeah, basically.
Except they were silver instead of black. Yeah.
Well,
the Tonic Sinclair 1000 was black, I think.
Yeah, it was black.
Oh, okay. That one was silver. Oh, because that's not a 1000, right? That was a weird later. Yeah, right. Okay.
That was a 1500. Right. That was a 1500.
That's right. Yeah.
Basically a 1000 with 8 times the memory, I think. And I remember that the 1000 had the same case as ZX81, but it had the Timex branding, and the ZX81 had the red, ZX81 stamped at the top. But anyway. Yeah, my brother-in-law had one. He was in college and used it and then a VIC-20 for some of his engineering coursework back in the early 80s.
Wow, that's he had some tough roads that he chose there. Straight from the ZX81 to the VIC-20. That's out of the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah, I know. He ended up with a Pocket Radio Shack, one of the Pocket supercalculators, and it actually was much more effective as a general computer than those two were for his purposes, I recall. We talked about it at the time.
Hard to do a lot of engineering in 22 columns.
So one thing about the 1500, I usually when I see the Timex Sinclair 1500, it is in one of these packages. So this was, okay. I think, a computer literacy, computer literacy set that people seem to have. So there's this same briefcase that has the cassette recorder, and this one actually has the materials as well.
That's cool. So it wasn't some homebrew thing. This was a kit that they sold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, technical literacy series.
Okay,
that's neat.
Interesting.
So they do come up with some regularity. They look, every time I see this, it looks inviting. In some way that I cannot quite quantify. But the 2068 looks a lot like that, but is actually more capable.
Vastly more capable, actually. It's actually impressive color, and it's just like the ZX Spectrum, which it is, except they took it and made it just enough of an incompatible unit that it didn't really translate.
Run ZX Spectrum software?
Right. It's basically
The 2068
hardware, the 2068, but it won't run it. The hardware's all there, but things are in different places. Mappings are different. There's a cartridge.
Why would they do that? That's maddening.
There's a cartridge that you can add to it that I've recently heard about. And the cartridge, I believe, alone, maybe you have to cut a trace or something on the board, but with that cartridge, you're pretty much compatible, from what I understand. And most of the software was on tape. It wasn't a big disk system, the ZX81. So, it's odd that they didn't, have it compatible from the start. It did not catch on in America.
I have my 2068 here.
Oh, you have one. Of course you do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, and do you have the cartridge?
You have the cartridge.
What is that in the back?
It allows, I forget what this is called, but this is it's joystick. Like a SD card thing. Connected to something that sort of rearranges the pins so that it will plug into the 2068, because this is the top thing is for a ZX Spectrum.
I see.
And I think this ROM in here is the Spectrum compatibility thing, so this can run Spectrum stuff.
Okay.
But it is a pleasing color.
Yeah, I remember I've never seen one in person, but I remember Creative Computing magazine would occasionally cover it, and I became aware of it only because of that. And they had some really impressive looking. I remember there was a 3D wireframe some kind of a demo running in the screenshots, and it was compelling to look at. I remember I wanted one as when I saw it, but luckily I didn't end up with one at the time. That would have been rough. I'd like one now, but so it sounds like from your adapter, not only is it internally different, but the connector on the back is also wired differently.
Yeah.
So okay.
So check your bingo cards at home. We've reached the part of the show where we talk about something impossibly obscure, and then Paul reaches out of frame and pulls out one of the three that he owns and says, "See, here it is."
Yeah. Yes.
It's one of these things that I've really been hoping to get to play with. For people who have used the ZX Spectrum, it has the same kind of keyboard. It's every key is overloaded by like a 5 different functions or something. So there's like all these modifier keys that you have to use at once. It's very
keys were expensive. Keys and RAM, those were the expensive things on a computer. So, Paul, do you just sit in like a sphere just outside of frame of retro computing hardware? Because you always seem to just be able to reach and pull something in that's exactly what we're talking about. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, perhaps I just guide the conversation. But, yeah, I don't know what I have. What do I have? I have the Apple III back there. I have a Next and a Vectrex here.
That's quite a spectrum, so to speak, of hardware around you.
I have a little pile of
and the
Macs.
The Sam Coupe is on the floor under the desk.
I don't yet have one of these, no. But
that's because they're fictional.
That's probably why.
They aren't real.
Okay, let's see. I thought this was sort of interesting. This is a SmartPad 2. Let's see if I can find one that's opened here. Maybe not. But anyway, it's for the Palm platform, and basically it's a little folio that on the right is a piece of notebook paper, and then on the left is this little sort of like Velcro thing that you can put the Palm Pilot in, and it comes with a pen. I don't know how it works, but it's a pen that on one end it has a stylus tip, so you can use it to run your Palm, but you can also just write on the notepad, and it's broadcasting somehow through the paper to the thing underneath, and letting you draw like straight onto the Palm. So there's a little wand up above that is broadcasting infrared to the Palm of what you're drawing over here on the pad.
Oh, okay. So there's probably a resistive touchpad under the paper, so you can probably only have like up to 5 sheets of paper or something sitting on top of it, or else it's not gonna, or else you have to push really hard when you write.
It is. It's an actual notepad, though. I was surprised. I was surprised at sort of like how thick it is. Let's see.
I'm guessing about how it works, because I can't imagine any other way that it could. Like, there has to be a touchpad under it.
It says use ordinary paper pad at the bottom. Yeah.
Sorry, placed on an embedded smart pad sensor in the portfolio for the data to transfer. I'm reading a tech review from CNN.com from the year 2000.
Okay. Amazing. Okay. We have to keep this researcher on staff. This is immensely helpful.
Mm-hmm.
We can just talk about stuff.
Anything in like 3 seconds. That's one of my tips. Yeah. They called it good idea, poor implementation, was the report on this device.
That's 90s tech in a nutshell right there.
The photo that just was shown, it looked like the pad had a keyboard. I guess you could use that for if you type directly on it under the paper pad. That's your keyboard for your Palm, I guess, if you want it. Interesting.
Yeah, you can lift the paper up and this serves as a keyboard.
Oh, interesting. And the Palm itself can't be moved from that like designated area on the Velcro strip, or else it would not be able to receive the infrared beam. That's wild.
Yeah, so you sort of anchored in this spot in the middle.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So the one thing about this pen is that it takes quadruple A battery.
Wow. Wow, I haven't seen one of those.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Good Lord.
Quadruple A battery. That's so interesting.
So this, yeah. the photos I've been showing is of the one that I have, but I don't have this battery, so I haven't had a chance to try it. But
I definitely do not have one of those in my house. They must have really needed that battery to go so obscure on the required power. I mean, I guess it's small, but
it has to fit in the pen. Yeah.
The more A's, the skinnier it is. So. Yeah. Presumably, they went to the four A's because they needed as skinny as possible to go in a pen. And I just Googled, and you can still buy those batteries. Quadruple A batteries are still a thing. I had no idea.
Now I want one.
I had never heard of it before this smart pad.
Wow, my brain was just expanded. That's crazy. Mm. Quadruple A. Huh.
Yeah.
But the thing does look nice, though. I mean, like it looks sort of executive. You can imagine bringing it to your...
It looks like an IBM product.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that both of the things both Blake and Bull have talked about so far have both been in containers, right? There's something very, for like transport, travel, whatever, this imagination of where technology is supposed to go, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, right? That was very much the 90s also, as we were imagining this mobile techno computing world that really didn't exist yet, but we kind of felt like it was gonna exist, and we were trying to like reach forward in time and grab it. Yeah, that was the story of the Newton for sure, which we talk about a lot on the show. Is this very aspirational device that the technology was just not really ready for.
Obviously, I'm just trying to imagine the guy at the board meeting like whipping out one of these, you know, his smart pad.
Well, although it might actually look better than the guy taking out the Palm Pilot and putting it on a fold-out keyboard, you know, that's a full-sized keyboard underneath it. Those look very funny.
Yeah, the smart pad actually has some stealth aspect to it. You could kind of lean it forward in front of you, and it would look like you were just writing on a pad, so you might get away with being the guy trying to make the technology work.
I'm trying to recall what system it was. I think it was a few shows ago we saw there was a... I guess it was a briefcase, and it was like a little one-line computer, you know, like a pocket computer, but it had like 10 devices in the suitcase that were all attached. Do you remember that? Do you remember what system that was? It was like a printer.
Yeah.
It had a disk drive, wafer tapes. It wasn't a TI thing, I don't think. But
it was like a Tandy PC-104 or something.
I wish I had that picture, because, that's like the extreme version of what we're talking about.
The thing I have on the screen is the fold-out keyboard with a palm. I used to do this on the train, but it does look really ridiculous. I mean, the keyboard is much, much too big for this little tiny Palm Pilot sitting on it.
Those keyboards were neat, though, the way they folded up. They were very, very clever. They were neat. Is that a current Amazon listing? Can you still buy those?
Yep, $22.
Wow.
Palm-sized.
You can look at an Amazon listing for the the smart pad, and all the reviews are from 2001, 2002.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty fun.
That's neat. So they must... I mean, sure, they don't make those Palm keyboards anymore, right? So they must just be sitting in some warehouse somewhere, and they're selling off the rest of them. That's wild.
I think, by the way, this is the Panasonic HHC system, and I think this is the one that that Blake may have been thinking of. It's got sort of like a computer part, and then there's a docking bar, and then you can put a printer on it, and they've got like a chip EEPROM programmer reader or something, and I think this is some kind of storage. There's a video unit you can put on there, but it's sort of like slots for your calculator.
I have, for the stream people, Quinn, I recently, well, not recently, I guess 5 years ago, purchased a USB foldable keyboard that...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
I needed to have something that I could tuck away, and it was actually to do some typing on a PS4 for a game, but you can just fold it away. And
that's pretty cool.
Little connector, but yeah, it was, I'm sure you can still... You can still get them, but it's handy. And actually, surprisingly, decent travel on the keys, which is odd. Oh, I forgot. This is actually Bluetooth.
Yeah, the Palm ones that I had seen, I don't know if that's the same one that we looked at, but I saw ones where they actually, the keyboard actually folded up to the same size as the Palm. Like it did some pretty clever mechanical hinging to make that happen. I almost wanted a Palm just for that keyboard because it was so clever.
Yeah, that was an official Palm product too.
Ah, okay.
There is, by the way, I forgot to mention this, but there's a YouTube video of handheld computing demonstrating the use of the smart pad. Oh, well, of course, now we have an ad. But anyway, I'll put a link in the show notes for the video that's showing someone actually using it.
Oh, look at that. That's neat. I still feel like you must have to press hard when you write. I feel like that wouldn't work unless you were really pressing because resistive touchpads were kind of clunky to begin with. You had to press reasonably hard on them. But now you're pressing through some number of sheets of paper on top of that. I'm guessing that does not work as well as it seems like it could.
And of course, you're taking your handwriting, your whatever visual you're putting on that pad and rendering it in the 300 by 300 pixel, you know,
right.
Palm,
that's a good point. Yeah,
palm
you're
display,
working on a,
which is
it's going to get scaled down terribly. You're going to write something small on the large piece of paper, and it's going to be illegible on the Palm.
Yeah. Like, great for drawing a snail, bad for writing more than six words.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, everybody's in the demos, everybody's writing enormously on the paper.
Yeah, that's right. Hello.
Giant writing, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there's going to be, a fairly common mishap where you're pressing hard on your pad with your pen, and then you move over to the Palm and you'd, like, push right through the
screen.
The screen with your pen. Forgetting to switch it over to the other side. I don't know.
Wash everything.
Okay. Let's see. I'll talk about this one. This auction. The next one is a Mac Recorder Sound Studio Pro, vintage 1992 Apple Macintosh recorder. It's new in box, so. I guess it's still opened. But I thought this was sort of interesting. So I feel like this participated a bit in my, early 90s Mac usage. It's sort of like audio editing software, and this is specifically a way to do sound input. But the company here is Macromind Paracomp. And I thought, I don't know, who is Macromind Paracomp? I thought I knew MacRecorder. I knew sound edit. But apparently... MacRecorder was Farallon initially. That's the name that everybody will know with SoundEdit and MacRecorder. And then Macromind Paracomp bought it, and then that turned into Macromedia. So what's interesting about this to me is that this is from that little twilight zone area between Farallon and Macromedia, where it was Macromind Paracomp. And also, I just have the nostalgia of the programs and, the interest of being able to see them exist in a box. The hardware is here, too, actually.
That's very cool. That reminds me what you're describing, the kind of the cusp of the software names. And, of course, I guess with our earlier talk about Sierra Online, there was, online systems, Sierra. But I remember for the Macintosh, Crystal Quest was by Cassidy and Green, the game on the Mac, and it made its way around to other platforms. But I remember looking at older magazines. I was, buying older Macworlds years later. I would see in the back there would be ads, two separate boxes, seemingly unrelated, one on top of the other, different products. One was like Cassidy Software, and the other one was like Green... Green development or something, and they were always near each other. And then, Cassidy and Green. So I guess that was just interesting. I've never dug into it, but it's kind of a similar thing here, I guess, with what you're saying.
All right, let's see. And I think the last thing I had was just a joke, which was what I wrote in the show notes was that often the sequels are less fun than the originals. But this is it's Breakout 2. It is a RS-232C problem solver. It's basically a little filter that you put, or a little dongle you put in your 25-pin RS-232 connections, so you can sort of see what's happening and figure out what's going wrong with your with your connection. It's a PC or PS2 DOS 2.1 kind of program. And nothing to do with the Breakout game.
I believe I actually used this device in one of my first jobs. Interesting. Monitoring, trying to control a radar unit for an airplane with C as a radar reader, and there was a need to figure out what was going wrong with the serial transmission. Something was not right, and I believe it was a Breakout device was what it was called that they gave us to work with. And happily, my summer ended before I had to get too deep into that one. It was unpleasant, but I'm almost positive it was Breakout was the name of the thing. It looked like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I have a thing. I think the purpose of this thing that I'm about to drop in there is sort of similar. You plug a RS-232 or like a 25 pin thing on each side, and then lights light up, and it tells you something about what's traversing this this path. I've never actually plugged it into anything, but it looks like it would look cool if I did. So maybe someday I will.
That's a picture of your item?
Yeah.
Okay.
Datatran.
Is it within reach of where you're sitting?
It is not. No. It looks like... Here's a picture of it on a chair. But anyway, yeah, I got this because I thought it might be... I could imagine it being sort of useful to diagnose such things. I mean, like, you know, if you're working with a fair amount of old modem type tech.
Or it would just look cool to have in line with whatever you're doing serial on a serial line. Yes.
Yeah, I do kind of want to just plug it in and see the lights blink.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think, you know, like serial communication doesn't use very many pins, so it wouldn't blink very many lights. I believe that it's...
I guess that's true.
They would be blinking very, very fast, though. I imagine you would just see dim flickering on all of them, unless the signal was intentionally stepping through some code on one end or the other to slow it down so you could see what the lights were doing. But
yeah. I recently learned that at least on DB25 RS-232, it actually has two separate serial signals on the cable, like one and two. Like you could have two serial ports, which is not something I realized earlier. I think DB9 might dispense with that, but that was in the original spec, apparently. Did you guys know that, or?
I don't think I did.
I didn't.
Okay. Yeah, it's strange. I was looking at the pinouts, and it wasn't often used.
As you do.
might partially explain why PCs had 25-pin serial ports, which I never understood. Like, what were they doing with 19 of those pins? Like, I never understood it.
Yeah, and I guess I thought, I remember, now that I think about it, I have the big TI, and I have the big peripheral expansion box, and there's a third-party serial card. It has two serial ports, but there's one DB25. I thought it was doing some, and it breaks out into a Y. I thought it was doing some kind of a proprietary thing, but apparently it was just using the standard double-loaded, you know, capability. Interesting, but tangent.
All right, I think that's probably enough of eBay. Blake, do you have any closing thoughts?
I unfortunately I've still not been able to spend any time with the Naboo that you people talked me into buying. I may wait for Naboovember in the end to get that rolling. But I do look forward to that. Otherwise, I just plan to spend some time this weekend poring over more pinout diagrams, as one does.
Right.
That's about it for me.
Excellent. Lane, I guess you're next alphabetically. What's up with you now that the book is published? Oh, how was the trip to the Internet Archive? I was going to ask you about that.
Oh, yeah. I should have talked more about that. So I did my book launch at the Internet Archive in San Francisco. Jason Scott is a longstanding buddy of mine. He was sort of an unofficial research assistant for me while I was writing this book almost entirely during COVID. When I thought of all the places, everyone thought I was going to do a New York book launch because that's where I'm located, and it was somehow weirdly easier to get space in San Francisco than it was to figure out how to get space in Manhattan. So it was really cool. It's a wonderful space. Everyone there was like so easy to work with. And it was quite wild. Unexpectedly, Apple employees number 5 and 12 came.
Wow.
So Rob Holt and Dan Kotke were in the audience, which was definitely anxiety-producing, you know? This is, you know, because, like, there's a way in which everybody who wasn't Wozniak has been totally overshadowed by Steve Jobs' role in the industry.
Yeah.
And so everyone else in this entire story has, like, not really been accounted for. And there's a way in which, like, that's not the goal of what my book is trying to do. I'm trying to do a, like, social and economic history of American personal computing. But I really felt for them, especially Rod Holt, who just, like, you know, like these figures who were so central to the formation of this company that so many people say they care so much about, and yet, like, we don't even really have a historical, like, a book about how the company happened. We have a lot about Jobs, right? But, like, everything that happened after that kind of initial launch and stuff that, you know, there's a lot of other people who worked there. and we did, you know, critical work. So that was super special. And I think Jason, I know he put, Jason Scott, I think kind of put the event out on blast to help make that happen. But yeah, a really wide range of, like, you know, other computer historians from some of the universities, folks who were just kind of like Internet Archive fans who kind of came in off the mailing list. Like, literally two people just came in off the street. And then, like, very hardcore Apple people. So a very funny mix of, like, what different people's needs were in the room. But it went super well. It was a real delight.
Was there stuff in the book that you wanted to include that you had to cut? Or, you know, what would you have done differently if you could have?
Yeah, there was a few things that, because I had to write the book on a crunch timeline, and because, especially when you write your first book, they don't let you write forever. And I was already like 20,000 words over the limit I was supposed to be. There were two things I kind of set aside in the book. So I walked you through that chapter, the organization of software categories. One of the ones that I didn't talk about, kind of just because of time constraint, was word processing. That was something that's obviously huge in the rationale for consumers to take up computing. I did that. I didn't write about it largely in part because there's another author, Matt Kirchenbaum, who wrote a book called Track Changes, A Literary History of Word Processing. And so he really did a kind of a history of how authors responded to word processing technology. And I was like, all right, Matt kind of covered this area. I'm just going to try and focus on other stuff. I also didn't talk about, like, CPM or operating system stuff. I felt that it kind of fell outside the category of the way I was thinking about software. And the other part is that the games chapter, I chose Mystery House, and that was also for reasons of expediency. I had basically already written a lot of that work. Because of all my prior work at Sierra. But I think if I could have chosen something from scratch, I would have done the original sub-logic release of Flight Simulator. I think that's probably a better example of, like, what it means, like, why games were sticky and what was unique about what they did for microcomputers in particular. And so, yeah, but those are just kind of, you know, a book is a series of trade-offs, right? So if both, like, time, energy, and so I'm happy with it. And the Mystery House chapter is good, but I kind of wish I had gotten to talk about something I haven't already discussed before. Yeah. And nobody talks about that particular game, right? It's like a really, I don't know, like, vestigial, kind of under-discussed, I think, object in gaming history. That, like, hung out on the bestseller list for, like, years, right? Yeah. Really surprising. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's also a great example of what we've talked a lot about here, which is the promise of computing somewhat overextending the reality of it. Flight Simulator, because I had Sublogic Flight Simulator, and you read the manual for that, and it seems super exciting. Like, oh, you're going to get to the landing gear and all the navigation and everything, and then you play the thing, and it is so slow, and it is so just not exciting.
Yeah, boring. Yeah.
I mean, they were pushing that hardware way past where they should have. And for anyone who doesn't know, it was a solid fill full 3D flight simulator that ran on an Apple II Plus and 48K. I mean, that has to be slow. It has to be. And it was. It was so slow.
It was
slow.
About 2 frames a second, I think. Basically about 2 frames a second.
I think it was slow. My memory of it was slower than that. It was like 1 frame every 3 seconds. Like, it was playable, but barely.
Interestingly, it's still here, though. You know, FS 2020, I play that almost every day. I recently upgraded my graphics card to better play Flight Simulator 2020.
Yeah, I think it is the longest running game franchise in the world.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not Mario, it's not Zelda.
Yeah.
Flight Simulator?
Like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so Microsoft, correct me if I'm wrong, but Microsoft published the Sublogic version and then later acquired Sublogic? Is that how that went?
I know that Sublogic published it, that for a brief period of time, Sublogic was an independent publisher, I believe.
Okay.
And then I think Microsoft buys the It's a good question whether they bought Sublogic or whether they just bought the rights to the game.
Okay. Yeah.
I know on all the other platforms, like it was on the Apple II, Flight Simulator 1, Flight Simulator 2, they were all from Sublogic Flight Simulator. But then when it came out on DOS, it was Microsoft Flight Simulator.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It was the same program. But so I know at least for DOS, Microsoft sold it. But, I mean, later on, like... for the Amiga, a much faster version. It was excellent. You know, came out, and the Mac and PC got better ones. It was still Sublogic on the Amiga. It was not anything to do with Microsoft, and that was in, like, 87.
Here we go. So it released the flight simulation as FS1 Flight Simulator for the Apple II in 79. It was one of the earliest release series.
Wow.
Released for the Apple II. So it definitely, would have been right one of the – something – only made possible by the Plus, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Microsoft licenses Flight Simulator in 82, and you can see in the sales charts of Apple magazines at that time that it was Microsoft's Flight Simulator because they had licensed the Sublogic rights. Yeah.
That 79, that's amazing. I mean, I respect the audacity of that, like to try and do that piece of software in 79 on that hardware. I mean, you're talking about serious 3D matrices crunching, you know, on a 1 megahertz 6502. Yeah. That's remarkable that they even attempted it, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sleeper historical game. Like, I'm just like, why is no one talking about this? Like, I can't do everything, people. Like,
yeah, that's right. Well, on that subject, what's next for you? Are you back on Sierra Online stuff, or?
I think I'm taking a break for a minute. You know, books also have this funny long tail where you launch them and then it's
that.
Just that man in the chair in front of the screen. It's such a you know,
it's very aspirational,
surreal image. It's like, do you want to live in this world? I don't know.
Yeah. Is that still shrink-wrapped, Blake? Is that an unopened Sublogic?
That's a Tandy one, yeah.
No, what I'm showing on the screen, it's a Tandy version. No, it's just glossy. It's not unopened.
All right.
It's pretty nice on the Color Computer 3, actually.
Yeah, I still have that box, actually, for my Apple II one, because I had a store-bought copy of it, but it's I think the box got crushed, so it's not that nice. But
I have a Sublogic t-shirt. Somebody said that, you know, they had merch.
Sorry, Lane, we cut you off. So long tail, books have a long tail, you were saying?
Yeah, so it'll be interviews and, you know, stuff like that for a while. And then I'm going to take a break and then kind of figure out what I want it's really intense about, I mean, I wrote this book in 2 years by basically writing about 90 minutes a day, 5 to 6 days a week. And that is, I just need a rest, I think, before I try and go back to and pull that off again.
Yeah.
So, because the Sierra book will definitely take will be bigger. I think it's going to be more like, if you've seen Malcolm Harris's new book, Palo Alto, which is like 700 pages on like California and the origins of capitalism. It's a pretty cool book. I think it's going to be more in that kind of weighty tome kind of territory.
Awesome.
Excellent. Let's see, I guess my closing notes are next. I have been editing. I haven't actually done a lot. I made up something to submit for Kansas Fest, so I'm allegedly going to work on another game on the Apple III. We'll see if that happens, or if I just change my mind entirely. But my idea was essentially that, like last year, I did what was kind of like a tech demo, writing a game using like all of the things that the Apple III can do that the Apple II can't. And what that led to is just sort of, well, a half finished game and something that was too big to really explain in the time I had. So what I want to do this time is kind of focus on a particular thing that it can do better than the Apple II, and like make a small game that maybe other people could then make better games than mine from. So. It all sounds very nice now. We'll see what happens in July. Quinn, any closing notes?
Yeah, I've been busy. So as many of you know, I'm Commodore curious, and I went and got a Commodore 64. And it took me a while to get it up and running, but just this past week or so, I finally did. So the first thing the Commodore people tell you is, if you have an original Commodore 64 power supply from the time, throw it in the bin, do not pass go, don't even look at it, throw it in the trash. The reason being, well, they were built like crap because it's Commodore, and don't at me, Commodore people. You all know that the hardware's crap, except their monitors, which are weirdly nice, mostly because they're all like rebranded Philips and Sony things. But so the monitors are weirdly super nice, but the Commodore-built hardware is basically trash. But so the issue with them is that the voltage regulator in them fails closed. So if, you know, old power supplies fail all the time, normally they just stop working and you get a new one. These things, when they stop working, they essentially dead short, and the 5-volt line goes to like 100 volts and takes the entire motherboard with it. So, and this will happen at random sometime between years 10 and 40 of your ownership of this power supply. So everybody agrees, if you have one, throw it away. And they're not repairable because it's a brick. It's literally the size of a brick. And it is solid epoxy inside. Like, they literally filled them with epoxy. I think it was for fire safety concerns. So they're just unrepairable. You can't open them and swap out the regulator for something better. So long story short, I ordered a new power supply. Now, the Commodore 64 community is so enormous and so popular that you can buy Commodore 64 power supplies, modern replacements, on Amazon, which blew my mind. But I Googled them, and that was the first hit. They're expensive on Amazon, but they do exist. However, I went to a fellow in Poland who makes them. I think the website is c64psu.com. He's got a whole line of replacement power supplies that are quite nice. There's ones for Amigas, and there's ones that work on the 128, and there's ones that also power your 1541, and all different options. So I bought his basic C64 one. It took a long time to get it here, obviously, from Poland, but it works brilliantly. It's a lovely little thing. And so I plugged it all in, flipped on my C64, all ready to live the 8-bit dream of color and sound that I'm not used to as an Apple II person, and nothing happened. So, however, credit to the Commodore community, I Googled the symptoms of what it was doing and immediately found instructions on what that likely is and how to fix it, which, again, try Googling anything Apple II. You won't find any help at all. But the Commodore stuff is just so ubiquitous. There's so many forums and websites and communities devoted to that machine that you Google things and you will find the answers. So in my case, the issue was a failing power switch, which is apparently very, very common. So my symptoms were: turn on the power, monitor flashes but remains black, and the power LED does not come on. Classic Commodore, the machine's actually on before the power LED comes on. There's two different power circuits, and the power switch is a double pull, double throw switch. And so a common failure mode is half of the power switch, half of the power works and half doesn't. So the machine powers up somewhat, but the other half of the power switch does not engage. So I'm sure there are replacement power switches available for it. I didn't want to wait for something else to ship again before I could play with this thing. So I took it all apart. To remove the power switch, you have to remove the EM shield on the back. And again, classic Commodore, the EM shield on the top is a piece of foil-covered cardboard, which was all delaminating and not doing anything. On the bottom, the power shield, instead of being in the case, like, you know, on an Apple II or an Atari, the EM shield is a piece of tin that's been soldered to the underside of the motherboard with these tabs. So to do any kind of work on the machine, you have to first unsolder 58 tabs that go all the way around the motherboard. And then you peel this piece of tin off, and then you can actually work on it. So then I unsoldered the power switch, tested it. Sure enough, half of it wasn't working. So you can actually peel the metal casing off of the switch. And I was able to expose the contacts and pull the contacts out and just manually clean them. They just had corrosion on them. Cleaned those, put it all back together, resoldered it, resoldered the EM shield on the underside of it, put it all back together, and it powered up. So it works. I played some Ghostbusters 2, which was the first floppy I found from the guy that I got this thing from. However, it's behaving strangely. It works perfectly for like 10, 15 minutes, and then it'll just lock up at random. So I don't know, maybe if there's Commodore people listening who might know what that is. It feels like maybe a RAM chip or something. I don't know what would cause a machine to lock up at random besides something like RAM. So I suspect either all the software I'm trying is really buggy, or there's something wrong with the machine that's causing it to lock up at random. So I haven't gotten very far with playing it just because of that problem. But also the keyboard is really dirty inside the switches. So it's doing that thing where like every third key press, it doesn't register, or you get double letters and stuff. So I think I have to take the keyboard apart and clean all the switches because it's really maddening to type on right now. But the best part is I got a Commodore 1571 disk drive with it that had the manual. So then the manual explains how to actually use the Commodore disk operating system, which we've talked about this a lot on the show. If you're a retro computer enthusiast who is not just doing it for the nostalgia and thus don't actually know how to use the computer because you didn't learn how to do it at the time, it's actually pretty difficult to figure out how to use this stuff now. So you go and buy a Commodore on eBay, it doesn't come with a manual, and you don't have the magazines and so on of the time teaching how to use these things. So how do you even learn how to load a program on a machine that you didn't have in the day? So luckily, it came with the manuals, so I read them and I learned, and I got programs to learn to load, and it was all very exciting. I was curious how bad the disk access was going to be, because Commodores, of course, have notoriously slow disks. It's not as bad as I expected, but also sometimes it just fails, and I don't know if that's, again, my particular Commodore, because sometimes something will take like 3 or 4 minutes to load, but then sometimes around minute two, it fails and locks up. And so you don't know, is it going to finish? Is it not going to finish? Is it doing anything? I don't know. Because the Commodore disk drive is really quiet and you can't hear if it's doing stuff and there's nothing on the screen. So at one point I left it for like 15 minutes and came back and it still hadn't loaded. So I think it had just crashed at some point during the loading. I don't know. So this whole Commodore lifestyle is taking some adjustment. I'm not used to this level of delay and unreliability and lack of feedback, but... If anyone Commodore people know what causes them to randomly lock up, please let me know, because I would like to get it running more reliably than it currently is so that I can actually play some stuff on it. But Ghostbusters 2 was delightful for the 5 minutes that I got to play it. I am
excellent.
Constantly reminded how hard 80s games were. Like, holy cow, they are so hard. As a 40-something adult, it's impossible to get anywhere in them. They're so hard. I don't know how we ever played those things. So, yeah, that's been my retro activity.
Excellent. Yeah, I do remember being marveling at that anyone would, you know to type whatever it is, like load $8, 1. I mean, like, you know,
yeah.
That's not very intuitive.
Well, and
no part of that is intuitive.
Yeah, and you learn that stuff as a kid or whatever, and it's like you just know it, and you don't think about when or how you learned it. The Apple has its share of that stuff too, right? Like there's no backspace key and we just all accept that. Like the Apple IIs don't have a backspace and every other computer user is like, what? How is there no backspace? You can't delete characters? Like how do you go back? You know, so that was refreshing. The Commodore has a backspace and it works. You just delete text that you typed. That's novel.
That's cool. And I guess it's true that PR number 6 doesn't actually, you know, that doesn't, you're not born with that knowledge.
Yeah. And I don't remember where I learned that, but it's so deep in my, you know, lizard brain, because I learned it when I was 5, that it's never occurred to me to question where I learned PR number 6, but you just know how to do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
But that too has almost no intuitive components.
Yeah, no. Yeah, even if you know where it comes from, like you understand that it's like print being output and then it's the slot number and it's, you know, and then you understand the I/O channels that are in the Apple II, like even if you understand why it's that way, it still doesn't really make sense that would cause the disk to reboot.
It is a super indirect path.
Yeah. Yeah, or 3D0G, you know, if you get trapped in the monitor, how do you get out? Like, or the big one on the Apple II is that if you just turn the machine on at a basic prompt, you can't do anything with the disk drive. Like, again, that's something where the Commodore has it beat. Like, you can turn the machine on and the operating system is in ROM. So you can just load disk, put in a disk and load games, and it just works. So I think that's the fact that the Apple II has these two completely different states that look identical. One has OS in RAM and one does not. And if you accidentally start doing work in this other mode, you're trapped there and you're screwed. Like, you can never save that work you did or never get out of that mode without losing the contents of RAM. Like, that's so, yeah, again, that's all stuff that you take for granted as a user of that system because you learned it at a young age.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I think we've now all had our closing notes and we can move on. So we did want to say at the going off point here that we have the places that you can get the Apple II Age, How the Computer Became Personal book. It's a Chicago University of Chicago Press book, right?
Yes, that is the publisher, so you can buy it on the website. The options there, I think if you scroll down, are cloth bound and PDF and EPUB. Cloth just means hardback. I don't know why they call it that. I've gotten more than a few emails very early on, especially from like retro computing and Apple folks who were like, what am I buying? Am I buying the cloth book? But yeah, that's just, so actually on the UCP, the University of Chicago Press website, it's already on back order. Apparently demand was so strong for before it was released that they ordered a second printing, but you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, like, you know, any books platform, you should be able to, any books purchasing platform, you should be able to obtain a copy. I find my one negative review really funny. I don't know if any, there's a man who was just like, I haven't read the book, but the cover is terrible. And I was like, what? The only Amazon review he's ever left. I was like, why are you ruining my life, sir?
Yeah. Plus there's literally an entire expression about not judging books by their covers.
Yeah. Yeah. He claims that that's an image of Elisa. I'm like, you don't even know your own facts.
No.
You get on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Libris, any website. It's in lots of warehouses at other companies, but the publisher itself, the hard copy is on back order. Mm-hmm. And there will eventually be an audiobook. I'm not sure how soon or I'm not sure how fast that's happening, but that is in contract. So I'm waiting to hear my different potential narrators. But
yeah, I was going to ask, so it's not going
to
be you?
Yeah, are you going to read it yourself?
No, I don't have to. But the audiobook company is the same one that did the audiobook for IWAS, so I thought that was a good sign. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah.
Nice.
I have sudden internet nerd rage to go and talk to that Amazon reviewer and explain the origins of that print shop image, because,
there's a whole section on print shop in the book.
Oh, it's important that people know this. Ooh.
Yeah, so also calls it Elisa when it's definitely a North Star advantage.
Exactly.
Yeah. I went on a little rant about Twitter about it, but you can kind of use context clues to figure out who he is if anyone wants to.
Okay.
It does trigger a memory, though, that I do remember being vaguely annoyed that the only image of a computer that Print Shop gave you did not look like the Apple II. Like, why did they go with that? Yeah.
North Star Advantage was the system that they prototyped on.
Oh, interesting. Oh.
Marty Kahn, and I was able to track down both David Balsam and Marty Kahn, and because no one had talked to them in like 30 years, basically. They had just, like, I really had to hit the bricks on this one to find these two guys. But Marty did a bunch of graphics programming at North Star, and so that was the computer system he was familiar with. He had an advantage at his house that he and David used to do their prototyping. And that is, I think, why that computer looks the way it does, because it's an advantage with, yeah, like, the side of floppy disk.
Oh, that's so interesting. Man, the truth is always better than you think it's going to be. That's so great.
It's like a super personal reference.
Yeah. Oh, man, you just answered a question five-year-old me had, and that the answer is so much better than I expected. That's great. I assume the answer would just be that they contracted out the art to someone who didn't really know what computers looked like or something.
No, Marty did all the pixel art or all the kind of breakdown of all the art images himself.
Wow.
I think possibly before I don't know when they knew it would be an Apple II product, but because they were working on it first on an Advantage, that was the thing that was sitting right in front of them.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's wow. Great note to end on. I love it.
Very interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real delight.
All right. Well, that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more via Gopher at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss it at the forums at a place at vcfed.org. You can follow RCR on Mastodon at podcasts.social at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute.